What will be the hot ingredients and cool dishes in 2018? A look at restaurant and home cooking trends for the new year. Even if you don't think of yourself as a trendy type of person, chances are food trends will find a way of seeping into your life. Maybe this year you will order something you've never tried before at a restaurant, or maybe you'll be invited to a dinner party or potluck and discover something new. After all, things like hummus, tacos, or even spaghetti were not always staples of the American diet. Food changes over time and sometimes faster than others. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will look at food trends emerging right now. From poke to ancient grains, fermented foods to hot pots. What are you craving? And what do you think will be just a blip on our food radar? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For the last few years, quinoa and kale have taken the food world by storm, as have new ways of dining. Think food trucks and ethnic cuisine. Well, today we're going to explore what's on the culinary horizon. Our panel of food experts is with me to share their take on what may be and may not be trending in the food world in 2018. In the studio with me, Peggy Gradinsky, who is food editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Nancy Harmon Jenkins is a cookbook author and historian and an authority on Mediterranean cuisine. And Sam Hayward is a pioneering chef and partner of 4th Street and Scales Restaurants in Portland. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you noticed new and different foods popping up at restaurants? Are you looking for ways to try new spices or techniques at home? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And welcome back to you all. So nice to see all your faces. Peggy, this is so cold out there. It seems funny to talk about food trends on a show. To talk about comfort food on a show about food trends. But comfort food is one of the trends right now, isn't it?
I think comfort food is a perennial trend. I don't think there's a year since 1995 that I haven't seen a food magazine say comfort food is a trend. So I think it always is.
Other than mashed potatoes, what would you say? What are you seeing a lot of writing about?
Meaning specifically about comfort food?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I guess I'd say the category has broadened. That in the past we would have said roast chicken, mashed potatoes, beef stew, and that today maybe we include some things that say kids grew up on that I didn't, like ramen or. Help me out here.
Well, you know,
I think what kids are eating is different, and then that as they grow up and they become millennials, then foods that they think of as comfort foods may be not the grilled cheese that I thought of as comfort food.
Right. It's funny you mentioned ramen because I don't eat ramen, but I hear that's a trend to start with ramen and add things to it in a different way.
Definitely true.
Hasn't ramen been around for an awfully long time? I mean, I kind of remember it over 30 years, at least, I think.
I mean, I think one difference is what again, I would say people younger than myself say, is that it started out to some extent in the United States, as a trend eating instant ramen in college, but really upscale, delicious ramen made from wonderful stock that you've spent 3 days making and with famous chefs interested in making it and lots of cookbooks about it, sort of the same with pho, it is a trend now. But can I also distinguish between, I think people use the word every year in 2018, people say the word, what's the trend, whether it's food or 100 other things, fashion, movies, et cetera. And I think trend and fad are different.
Yes.
I think a lot of the things that people talk about and say are trends, say a few years ago it would have been cupcakes, are really fads. And we just get enamored of them and lots of stores or restaurants spring up and there's lots of cookbooks and then they're gone. Whereas there are trends, I guess I would argue, say, farm-to-table eating, which have a much more sustained life and have a much more serious impact on the way we cook and eat.
I think that's a really good point. And it's interesting that we're talking about trends, Sam, because farm to table is nationally a trend. But for you, this is the last 25 or 30 years of your life.
I guess that's true.
More than that. Even,
yeah, I think that's true. And I agree with what Peggy says, that when I think of trends, I think of what's really long term. And I hadn't really thought about applying the term fad to some of the things that are going on, like cheese tea.
Yes. Oh, yes. We talked about that last week.
Oh, did you really?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. It's a new fad.
Oh, dear. I tend to stay away from those things.
And even food that's in and out. I've been noticing aioli on every single menu. Now, obviously, that's a food, as Nancy could tell us, with a very distinguished pedigree. But I tend to think that's sort of a fad. We're in love with it right now. And when I look at menus 6 years from now, I suspect I'll see it less.
Although, in that case, I'm not even sure that what they're advertising on the menu is aioli.
It's not
aioli. It doesn't have any garlic in it. It may have a whole lot of other stuff in it. So it does have an egg yolk and oil emulsion.
It's mayonnaise, basically.
Yeah. Basically, with other
aioli has become the faddish way to refer to mayonnaise. Right. So if you put sriracha in the mayonnaise, it's sriracha mayonnaise. It's not sriracha aioli.
But that's not what the server says.
Right. The server mispronounces it anyway.
So. As I just did. Thank you.
I'm sure you did. It's aioli, you know, it depends. I mean, the servers are notorious for mispronouncing things. And Lord knows, I don't expect them to have graduate degrees in some of these weird languages that we're speaking. But I want to come back to the comfort food again, because I think this really is a trend. I think it's a very strong trend. I think Americans, and I'm just talking about Americans as a whole and not about the entire world and not about specifically Maine, but it comes down to something that we have in Maine, and that is this kind of feeling of just deep-seated unease about where we are in the world. And it emanates from Washington, but it also emanates from other parts of the country. And there's a real sense. You're going to laugh at this because this is a real fad. Hygge, I think that's how you pronounce it.
Right? I just learned about that. Yeah.
Well, I heard about it last year, so it's already old hat.
Hygge is what I was told.
That may be the way to pronounce it.
Yeah. But anyway.
In any place. It's spelled H-Y-G-G-E. It is a Scandinavian concept, and I'm not sure which country gets the most credit for it. Maybe Denmark. But it has to do with this kind of settling into your home, which is what we do in Maine in the wintertime anyway. You know, you build up a fire, you put some soup on the stove, or you roast a chicken in the oven, or you whip up some aioli to go with it. and you gather around the table with family, friends, you know, maybe even a few strangers you pick up on your daily rounds. And you enjoy your food in a much more domestic way than going out to restaurants. But I think it also is reflected in restaurant menus. There are menus that are still terribly outlandish, but a lot of restaurant menus are coming back to that simplicity and straightforwardness of a kind of home-based cuisine. Do you think that's true, Sam?
I do. I also think in the case of 4th Street, we never got away from that.
Right,
that was sort of the concept from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Summer, winter, spring, and fall. It was what we were
about.
But
Sam, when you started that, wasn't that unusual in the restaurant world?
Possibly in Maine. In the professional chef-driven restaurant world, I think all of us were looking to show off our craft and our creativity to the greatest extent possible. And in some cases, that didn't necessarily bring us to the best and highest use and the most comfortable use for many of the ingredients that we were so painfully sourcing. But I think also, and taking off from what you said, Nancy, I think comfort food also has something to do with standing in direct contrast to industrial food and the food that the industrial system provides to us and tries to sell to us. So when you think about the antithesis of that, it's actually that roast chicken or some baked beans that you have worked for 16 hours to produce, and things that are just soul satisfying and deeply enduring and filling and full of energy and full of love and home and memory and nostalgia. All of those things figure into that to me. But primarily for me, it's avoiding industrial food.
Mm. But I mean, I guess I'd say it's a paradox. I think you could make an equal argument that that all sorts of poke, vegan, maybe Cape gooseberries, if you want to come up with an ingredient, that all sorts of foods that are not comfort foods traditionally in America are equally hot right now. So
sure,
I guess I would say it's a broad tent.
Poke. What is poke? P-O-K-E.
I'm glad to hear how it's pronounced because I've been calling it poke.
Our amazing producer, Cindy Hahn, told me that it was poke. Poke is raw fish, correct? But not sushi. And that's all I know.
It's Peggy? Sort of the Hawaiian take on raw fish. I mean, they're obviously Hawaii had many, many historically Japanese workers go there. So they have lots of century-old Japanese food traditions. So I would say it's sort of the Hawaiian take. There's a type of sushi you very rarely see in the U.S. It's called jirashi sushi, which is a bowl of rice. maybe you'd say, if you were a former English major like me, deconstructed sushi. it's sort of a bowl of rice with pieces of fish and some other things over it. And in some ways, I'd say poke is a little closer to that, although it also, I think, often involves seaweed, and we've, to some extent, Americanified it, I would say, even though Hawaii obviously is American, by adding all kinds of things that maybe would have been less traditional there. I don't know. I think it's interesting. Speaking of comfort food, I see my colleagues where we've now moved to Portland, and we're not near so many wonderful restaurants in the downtown area, but we are near some poke places, and my colleagues eat it often for lunch, and I feel like I can't imagine wanting that in winter. In winter, I do want the traditional comfort food, roast chickens, et cetera.
Or roast fish.
Roast
but
fish.
It has to be, I think it has to be warm to be comfort
yes,
food.
Yes, exactly.
I think it's fascinating.
Sort of
this whole
warm.
Raw fish business is so interesting to me because I go back longer than almost anybody else. And I remember a time when the idea that Americans would be scarfing up raw fish like mad all over the country in tiny little towns like Rockland, Maine.
Yeah.
Would be just outlandish. Nobody would be able to believe it. And yet, the other thing that's interesting about it is nobody stood, there was no industry behind it. Nobody stood to gain anything from promoting the consumption of raw fish. It just became something we adopted. And it probably was a fad in the beginning, but it has become a trend. And now it's really a traditional part, whether it's poke or sushi or crudo, which is a kind of Italian invention. It's become an essential part of dining out. I think very few people actually serve this sort of food at home. But dining out, it's become something people look for.
Well, I want to talk about that idea, too. It kind of goes back to you saying trends versus fads, Peggy, because people, and I said this at the top of the program, people may not think of themselves as trendy, but whether you think of yourself that way or not, you are probably taking part in food trends. I remember talking to a goat cheese maker who talked about when she was starting out going to fairs and events in all over Maine trying to get people to try goat cheese because that was such a strange and foreign thing and they were so skeptical. And now it's something that even at the Hannaford are all sorts of flavors and crumbled and not crumbled and spreadable. And goat cheese is just sort of omnipresent. Same with hummus. Nancy, you're a food historian. Give us a sense of what people were eating 100 years ago that they would like you were talking about raw fish, that they would never have dreamed they would be eating today.
Well, I think that's one thing. It's raw fish for sure. And also all these things that we put in a category called ethnic food, which means food that's not white bread American, if you will. That's not maybe that's not connected with a kind of European American culture. Certainly, there was no Chinese food. I remember the first time I had Chinese food. It was on Tremont Street in Boston, and it was sweet and sour pork, a dish that I would refuse to have now. But I thought I'd died and gone to heaven, and I was probably about 6 or 7 years old. That kind of food just wasn't available. We ate meat and potatoes and vegetables. We had cake or cookies for dessert. We had a breakfast that was bacon and eggs and or cereal of some kind. But that's not 100 years ago because I'm not that old, Jen, but I I remember people talking about it. I think food was, A, much plainer. B, it was also much closer to the source. than anything that I actually grew up on in Maine in the 50s and 60s when everybody turned to this industrial food because it was cheap, it was available, there was a kind of
easy,
sophistication to it.
That was the trend.
Yeah.
I mean, we look down our nose on it now, but that was absolutely the trend in the 50s. My grandmother's everything came out of a can because that was the swanky, glamorous thing to do at the time.
Or the freezer.
Yeah, right. When my grandmothers were young housewives.
Swanson's chicken pot pies. Yeah.
It was a treat. I mean,
yeah.
it was
I
well, loved partly it. Because we got to eat it in front of the television.
Right,
so
exactly.
I want to talk about another trend that's it's been around for a couple of years. They're calling veg-centric. I saw a term this morning that I had never seen before. Veg forward.
Yeah.
Sam, are your restaurants veg forward?
Well, I saw those.
First, tell me what that means.
Good question. I saw those two terms myself just the other day and thought, we've bandied about the term plant-based for a long time. And many of us in the restaurant business have dreamed about doing plant-based menus that maybe had some animal protein in it, but maybe was de-emphasized on the plate or on the menu. And I've thought about that concept for literally 25 years and never got around to actually making it happen. I think the time may very well be right, and increasing the amount of plant food against animal protein is definitely a trend, and there are so many reasons why that'll remain. That said, I think it's also really important to keep in mind that there are a lot of people there are many parts of our dining audience in Maine, and there are still going to be people out there who think of going to a restaurant as meaning they're going to go get a 12-inch steak or 12-ounce steak, and that's probably not going to go away. So we're going to be accommodating different elements of the public in different restaurants in different ways.
When we're talking about veg-centric or veg-forward, are we talking about things like Chinese food, beef with broccoli, or an Indian food? Are we talking about Southern food like collard greens that have been cooked maybe in a ham hock? Or are we talking about something else?
I think we're talking about Mediterranean food. And I only don't just say that because I love the Mediterranean and because it's just gotten a huge seal of approval. But beyond that, I think the kind of vegetables that come out of the Mediterranean and the ways they're treated are things that are very, very familiar. I like to say it's a vocabulary that's familiar to American cooks. It's easy for us to use tomatoes or peppers or eggplants or fresh beans or anything like that. We know how to do it, even if we don't necessarily do it in a Mediterranean way.
So you're talking about maybe like an eggplant stew that maybe has a little bit of a sausage in it or maybe has
a little bit
of fish in it.
It's what I like to call almost vegetarian, where you have, and this is very typical of Mediterranean cooking, where you have a very small amount of meat that adds flavor and structure to a sauce or a stew, or a pasta sauces are an excellent example of that.
I actually think I think veg forward and veg centric were 2014. I think we're ahead now. I mean, when I look at the cookbooks I get in, a piece of it is that we run a vegan columnist. So a lot of cookbook publishers who notice that send us vegan cookbooks. But I got more vegan cookbooks this year than when you work in a newspaper, publishers send you new cookbooks because they're hoping you'll review them or be interested in them. I cannot tell you how many vegan cookbooks I got. And I would say, hardcore vegan, not putting a little bit of meat and making sure the veg is not the center of the plate, as maybe would be true of some Chinese food and other Asian food. But really hardcore vegan to me is a hotter trend, I guess.
But
I'd
it's
say.
A category for publishers. Do you think that the public
That's
responds
true too.
To it?
I do think the public's responding to it a lot more. I think chefs are responding to it a lot more, and chefs drive it. I think the two new burgers, the Impossible Burger and whatever the other one is, that bleed, but they're not meat. I actually think, and I think as Sam said, for lots of reasons, one of them being the growing population and the need we'll have to feed ourselves, that vegetables often take less resources.
And I think
to grow.
A lot of people, even if they're not becoming vegetarian or vegan, are trying to cook that way once or twice a week.
Exactly.
And maybe buying a cookbook to get some ideas because they don't even know where to start.
Yeah, can I just comment on a couple points? That we've, one to comfort food, one that we didn't mention, and it's not necessarily toast with jam and butter, but certainly toast could fall into both comfort food and trend, and it's
and fad.
Right here and fad, and it's right here in the Portland area
India.
Now, exactly, with Toast Bar. The other thing I was going to say is I think it's interesting where trends come from. So goat cheese. This may, you know, there was a very famous cheesemaker in California in about 1975 named Laura Chanel, and she brought goat cheese to Alice Waters at Chez Panisse, and then Alice Waters came up with a salad with goat cheese and was it beets and candied walnuts or something that became ubiquitous, but at that time was a very fresh new concept for Americans, and so I think sometimes trends are very traceable to or cupcakes. I think weren't they on. The show with the three women set in New York, Sarah Jessica Parker.
Sex in the City.
Yes, yeah. Sex in the City. They went in one episode. They went down to
Magnolia
Bakery.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to go to a break, but I have so many things I want to talk about. We're talking with Sam Hayward, Peggy Grodinski, and Nancy Harmon Jenkins about food trends. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as do Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco. And Norman Hansen and Detroit, a law firm dedicated to providing effective legal solutions for businesses and individuals. NHDlaw.com.
This week, in an encore broadcast of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Lahav Shani leads the BSO in Schubert's great C major symphony, as well as Mendelssohn's violin concerto with soloist Joshua Bell. Join Ron Della Chiesa for the Boston Symphony Orchestra in concert.
That's coming up this evening at 8 o'clock over on the stations of Maine Public Classical. If you're a fan of Maine Public Television's Victoria on Masterpiece Theater and are eagerly awaiting the January 14th start of Season 2, we have a special Season 2 preview coming up in Ellsworth. The Ellsworth showing is on this Saturday evening, January 13th, at the Grand. Doors open at 6:30. The showing is at 7. Tickets are free, but they should be reserved. Visit mainepublic.org and click on events to do that and for more information.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Trends in the Food World. With me in the studio, Nancy Harmon Jenkins is a cookbook author and culinary historian. Sam Hayward is chef and co-owner of 4th Street and Scales. And Peggy Grodinski is food editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. You know, we've been talking about the trend toward comfort food, toward, you know, non-industrial food, vegetable-based dishes. But at the same time, at least in the Portland area, we are seeing more and more donut shops. Is that because with every sort of healthy trend, we need a little something that's a little wicked to entice us?
That is a national trend, I want to say, even though donuts have a place dear to the heart of Mainers. That's true all over the country.
Well, also it's true that we have the only true donuts here because we have cake donuts and the rest of the country has yeast-risen donuts, which are perfectly horrible to any New Englander. I think what happened in the case of donuts is that there was a really, really fine donut shop here in Portland and it got so much attention. And people would drive from
Camden. You're
talking
about Holy Donuts?
Yes. Mm-hmm. My sister would drive from Camden to buy their donuts. And other people said, hey, we can do that too. It's easy. You know, you get a donut cutter and you get some dough and you get some sugar and
do you think,
you're in business.
I feel like trends tend to be far more national these days because of social media that chefs, you know, and others and people who own donut shops and see the trends nationally and internationally on all sorts of blogs and magazines and food network, and they don't tend to be very regional. So donuts is a funny one to me because in one sense, of course, you know, New England feels like the home of the donut, and in another sense, it is very much a national trend. And I would argue really that there was a famous donut shop in New York about 15 years now ago called something like Donut Laboratory, but I've got that wrong. And that started Americans' love, revived the trend of Americans' love of donuts.
But in New England, in Maine, certainly, we never we never turned our backs on donuts.
That's true. Who would?
I've made a detour to go through Camden early in the morning on different trips to go to Boynton McKay and get those beautiful big cake donuts fresh, and they never put any goop on them, and they're just plain cake donuts, and they're perfect.
The terrible thing that's happened to donuts is, we were discussing this earlier, this increasing variety of things. You know, if a donut, a plain molasses or apple cider donut is the best thing in the world. So let's put some chocolate on it. And now that we've got some chocolate on it, let's add a little marshmallow and maybe some jam inside.
How about some pumpkin spice?
Yes, exactly.
No,
got this horrendous thing.
October is over. I mean, November's over, and you're not allowed to use those words again.
Believe me, that's the first time I've used them in years.
That is the danger of trends generally, that they start as one thing and then the... You know, people get very excited. They morph.
Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Bangor. Mike, it's snowing up there, I hear.
It is. And I wanted to comment on ramen, which in Korea is ramyun. And I got sent to Korea in 1968, which is when I discovered ramyun. And the high-end brand was Samyang ramyun, which was 20 won a pack, which is the equivalent of 3 U.S. cents a pack. And I've been eating ramyun ever since. And my favorite way to prepare it is to prepare it as a noodle dish, not as a soup. You add about a tablespoon of chunky peanut butter and break an egg into it, stir it all up, and it's just incredible.
Yum.
Well, thanks for the tip. I like that.
It's a new trend.
thanks, Mike, for your call. We're going to go from Mike to Michaela, and Michaela is calling from Portland. Hi, Michaela, go ahead.
Hi there. I wanted to make a point of disagreement on your topic. I think especially in Portland and Southern Maine, things are more vegetarian-friendly and more vegetable-oriented, but I think the bigger trend is moving from things that we know to more to the unfamiliar. I think we have a lot of restaurants that are coming into the area that are like new American and Italian. Those restaurants aren't sticking around, like Roustabout, like Victoria Fanny. But what's sticking around are places that are completely new to this sort of region, and I think that's what people are really interested in. At least that's the trend in Portland.
I think there is some. I think Americans are so questing always as a nation, certainly not just in food. I think that you could make that a general cultural comment, but very much in food, certainly in the last 30 years. And again, I would argue nationally, not just in Portland or in Maine. The new and the exciting, the sushi, as we talked about, I certainly remember when that came here. Even you know, right now it's very much, I would say, to some extent, Middle Eastern and Asian, Southeast Asian food, but all kinds of, we love the new.
Thank you, Michaela, for your call.
So I agree with that, for sure.
We have a...
Italian was new only 25 years ago. The reason Italian restaurants were all opening is Americans had a very limited idea of Italian. And at one time, that was as exciting and unusual as Korean feels to Americans today.
Caroline writes in an email, how much is global climate change or climate change right in the Gulf of Maine impacting food trends here in Maine?
Oh, boy. Seafood. It's a big one. No shrimp. Very few mussels because the green crabs have moved in and are eating up all the mussels. New fish species moving in. Sam can talk about that. The great worry, of course, is the lobster because that's what Maine's economy really, in the end, relies on. And people who think about these things are terrified of what's going to happen.
Yes, the combination of the warming waters and the potential of the acidity of the ocean harming lobsters. And Sam, I know that for years, we're supposed to be talking about food trends here, but for years you've been a part of a group of people trying to encourage people to eat more kinds of fish than just haddock, cod, and salmon.
Well, and in fact, when I first moved to Maine back in the 70s, just about the only local fish that people really wanted for menus was haddock, which is terrific fish. But there are so many members of the cod and haddock family that are equally delicious. And one of my favorites is red hake, which has a lot of the characteristics of both cod and haddock in that it's white, it's tender, it's delicious and sweet, but also has a kind of a richer, stronger, more oceanic flavor than the other two that I just mentioned at its best. But it's wonderful fish and it's much less expensive. And Nancy's right. There are some things that are really happening to the ecosystem in the Gulf of Maine that concern a lot of us. And one of the problems with mussels, for example, has been, I hope I'm saying this correctly, domoic acid from a particular kind of algae bloom that seems to be happening more frequently than it had
and
in
later
the past.
In the season than before.
So even our farmed mussels, which are generally hanging from rafts a little bit offshore, are susceptible to that kind of limitation. And you didn't mention scallops, but I know that that's another one of our winter fisheries that's really important to me. And I believe that that's the second highest value fishery after lobster in Maine, even though it's such a tightly managed and seasonal fishery. And they're fantastic right now. This is the best time of year for them. And we didn't mention urchins, which are not a popular dish.
And but most of our important.
Very important, especially in Washington County. And many of them get shipped elsewhere.
That most of them do, I think. I think that's too bad because urchin roe is such a delicious,
it's so wonderful,
delicacy.
And trendy again.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like to join the conversation about food trends, what do you find yourself interested in right now, either finding on a restaurant menu or cooking yourself? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Peggy, I understand that pickling and fermenting are hot now.
Yes, I feel like I can't go to a restaurant in the greater Portland area without seeing house-made pickles on the menu. And yesterday I had a fried chicken sandwich at Big J's Shack, and there were these super delicious, even better than the chicken, was the pickles.
Oh, that
pickles
sounds good.
Pickles were just really delicious.
It does sound good, yeah.
I have to tell you what my daughter did the other day, which just stunned me. She was making foie gras, the little dishes of foie gras pate for New Year's Eve, and she put in them pickled mustard seeds.
Yum.
And I thought they were fabulous because they pop in your mouth when you eat and give this little kind of push of acid that comes out. It's just fabulous.
And that is
new pickled mustard seeds.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And that also is, you know, very much a trend that hits on both the comfort food level.
Yeah.
Certainly our ancestors were pickling and fermenting and is a very modern trend at
and
the same time.
And pickling and fermenting for different reasons, to put away food for the winter.
Yes.
That was exactly it.
Exactly.
We put them away at 4th Street for the same reason, that we have this plethora of stuff just coming in by the ton in September and October. And that's one of the ways that we deal with it in a flavorful way that contributes to the foods of winter.
Which often need that sort of acidic perk.
Yeah, the blandness of all those root vegetables and squashes and things like that really need a good sour pickle along with them.
We're going to go to Jesse, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Jesse. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I'm the general manager over at Solo Italiano, and I just wanted to say how much I enjoy listening to this show. I've heard Sam on it a couple of times. But I wanted to speak to something that our chef talks about frequently, which is rich flavor, but also in conjunction with simple ingredients. You know, one of the things that Paolo likes to say is how fortunate we are in Maine to have such fantastic farmers. And, you know, he's able to make his pesto with simply just beautiful basil. And, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that we can do as consumers is consistently support these farmers because they're able to bring us something that's the most fabulous from the land, which is just our products. And we can let them shine every day.
Jesse.
Yeah. That's so true, Jesse. And, you know, the other thing is that we're finding more and more of our farmers are extending their seasons in both directions so that you can get good basil and good salad greens at this time of year and not through a lot of energy consumption, but through wise farming.
And, Sam, you're nodding here.
Oh, absolutely.
Here.
I mean, I just have found out that a longtime farmer, a farmer that we've been using for a long time, has recently moved to my town, Bodenham. So Bodenham, once again, has another great farmer moving into town who's going to be doing four-season farming.
Fabulous.
It's amazing how that's...
I went to the Brunswick Farmers Market a couple of weeks ago. You know, the problem is a lot of these farmers markets close down in the wintertime. The Brunswick Market stays open on Saturdays in the Fort Andros building.
Okay.
And boy, I was blown away by the quality of the food overall, but especially the quality of vegetables that were available there. It was very impressive.
Jesse, thanks so much for calling. We'll move to Karen, who's calling from New Sharon. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Hi. So I like to, like, one thing you missed when you were discussing comfort food is home macaroni and cheese, which is something that my mom used to make when I was a kid. I've been able to, like, change her recipe a bit so that it's healthier and it's not full of white flour. You know, using different kinds of noodles and more vegetables and taking the ham out. So that was one thing. But the other thing that I like to do is just, and one of the things that I'm kind of excited to see in a lot more recipes is turmeric. And this past weekend, I was coming down with a cold, and I made a lovely chicken soup with turmeric and coconut milk that was just fabulous, and I'm regretting that it's almost gone now. So that's all I wanted to say, and thanks for the show.
Well, thanks for calling. And I do believe that different takes on macaroni and cheese is indeed one of those trends. So, Karen, you are either causing or right in there.
And turmeric, for sure, which is a beautiful color to eat in winter because it's so sunny and cheerful.
And now you can even get the fresh turmeric root in several different stores, which is fantastic.
What do you do with that, Sam?
I just grate it. I wish I could say I use it all the time, but it's another one of those great flavoring and coloring and aromatizing roots like ginger and galangal.
I'm
terrific
to
use.
Quite skeptical of that you can ever eat enough of one food to really be as antioxidant or good for you as other people say. But I was listening to a neuroscientist, I think, on Maine Public Radio just the other day, who said that there are actually some very promising studies that turmeric is counteracts Alzheimer's.
All right. That's exciting. Karen, thanks so much for calling. And I think ginger has all sorts of fantastic quality. And garlic, of course, Nancy.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of those, we mentioned the Middle East, or I think Peggy mentioned the Middle East. I think a lot of these Middle Eastern and South Asian ingredients that we tended to kind of dismiss in a way are really entering into our cuisine in very interesting ways. And turmeric is certainly one of them. Yeah. And then I think of the spice mixtures, and turmeric can play a role in that too. I think of za'atar, for instance, the Middle Eastern spice mixture. I throw it on my eggs in the morning and it's delicious, just delicious. It's something that you can use in everything. You can use it on chicken, you can use it on fish, and it's all full of good things for you, and the same way that turmeric is too. You get in the habit of throwing a dash of that in here and there, and pretty soon you get very used to the flavor, and you want that flavor in whatever you're cooking.
I think I'm going to have to buy some za'atar. But we do have to take a break. Before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to talk about ice fishing, how it works, where to go, and the role it plays in Maine's culture and economy. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical.
A new NPR investigation finds that some of the most vulnerable people in the country suffer one of the highest rates of sexual assault.
Folks with intellectual disabilities are the perfect victim.
In group homes and institutions, at school and at work.
If this were any other population, the world would be up in arms.
Intellectual Disabilities and Sexual Assault, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
As the nature of war has changed, so has the military.
From their humble origins in World War II, the Special Operations Forces have gone from being very minor players to being at the forefront in much of what we do.
But is this strategy sustainable? And can small elite teams lead to major victories? A look into U.S. Special Operations next time on America Abroad.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program, What is Hot on the Culinary Scene? Joining me today, Sam Hayward, chef and partner at 4th Street and Scales, Peggy Gradinsky, food editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Nancy Harmon Jenkins, cookbook author and culinary speaker and historian. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Colin calling from Portland. Hi, Colin. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on. And I just wanted to say a couple things because I've been a chef in the industry for the past, 14, 15 years now. And the amount of trends I've seen in that time, I worked at a 3-star Michelin restaurant in Napa. And, I worked in Portland, actually, at 555 for a little bit. And what I've seen is people are kind of going away from the fine dining and going to simpler things, And with that being said, chefs aren't wanting to work in that fine dining atmosphere anymore. So you're finding less, simple food that's not being, tampered with as much, which gives the patron a better product ultimately.
Colin, thanks for calling. Yeah, we did talk about that a little bit at the beginning. I appreciate you adding to the conversation. We have a couple emails here that I was going to ask you guys about this anyway. This is from John, an email. I'm personally fascinated by regional variations of pizza, and I have a soft spot for convenience store / local pizza joints in Maine. I love the sense of loyalty many have to their local pizza places. And although Otto's is great, my favorite pizza is often made in gas stations or hole-in-the-wall places. Shout out to Duck Pond Varieties Bar. Barbecue pizza and Toby's in China. Well, and what I was thinking is, it seems as though this market, it seems as though more and more and more pizza places open and they all stay in business. Is there a ceiling, or will this just continue for eternity?
It is amazing. We just had 2 or 3 new ones open in the Rockland area. And I find it, I mean, they're all making excellent pizzas. How can they compete with each other? But I tell you, if my 10-year-old grandson wants to go out to dinner, what does he want? Either a burger or a pizza, one or the other, and nothing in between.
I'd ask the same question of, certainly in Portland, bakeries. The number of excellent bakeries is just beyond belief, and they new ones seem to open all the time. And certainly coffee shops. Like, how much coffee can we drink? And yet they all seem to survive and thrive.
We have 2 different people, Jim sending a tweet and Nick sending an email about insects. Anybody here cook with edible insects?
No.
Well, I'll try anything at least once. And I haven't cooked any for an audience here yet. But I do have to tell you that I feed my chickens a treat, which is dehydrated meal moth larvae. They look like big segmented worms. And so I'm feeding them to my chickens who give us eggs. I thought I'd try them myself, and I'll be darned. They're really not bad.
Oh, God.
Well, and aren't grasshoppers cooked a certain way?
Yes,
a Mexican specialty?
Sure.
Desert lobster. Yeah.
And those big water bugs that you sometimes see in Southeast Asian shops on a tray wrapped in cellophane. And I don't know what is done with them, but they certainly are considered a prize somewhere.
I think you'll have to call us back for the 2025 trend show. Yeah. I don't think
we're too early to
yes,
call this
exactly.
A trend.
But look for protein additives made from insects and insect meal. That kind of thing is going to be introduced into food products almost immediately.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that I had an insect infestation in my home kitchen maybe 15 years ago, and I was talking to the mother of a friend of mine who grew up in Indonesia during World War II, and I was appalled. They're in all my grains. Everything has an insect. Do I have to throw everything out? And she was very casual. Just protein. We ate it during the war all the time. It's fine.
Makes sense. So. We'll go to Bath and Christoy. Hi, Christoy. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Hi, Sam.
Hi.
I remember you from the days of the 22 Lincoln and down in Brunswick. I don't know if you remember that.
Vaguely. How are you?
Yeah, there we go. So I'll make some quick comments and then let you guys go to it. I'm interested in hearing about this balance between fusion cooking and local cooking. And so, for example, one of the things that I've done lately is I've planted saffron. So now saffron is now local, at least, for me. But, originally it would not have been considered, a local ingredient. So I'll hang up and...
Okay. Thanks for calling.
I will interrupt here to say that Martha Ballard was growing saffron in her garden on the banks of the Kennebec River in, 1785, 1790?
and harvested it on the 26th of September,
right,
as I recall from the book. And as a matter of fact, my gardener at 22 Lincoln planted saffron crocuses at my request around that building. And one of the last years that I was there, I harvested it myself by hand.
Wow.
And then used it in a dinner at the Beard House.
It takes a lot of saffron,
really does.
Doesn't it?
It takes a ton of down on your knees work to pull. It's difficult.
It's expensive, but it's worth paying the price.
Right, it really is. Yeah.
That is a great question, though. I mean, once we're growing something here, I've seen okra increasingly in farmers markets, right, and I assume that's really a southern crop, not a northern one. Maybe going back to the question about global warming, I don't know. But it's, you know, if we grow it here, ergo, right, has it become local?
And we're incorporating more vegetable and grain ingredients from elsewhere. That right now, I just, for the first time, from Wild Folk Farm in Fairfield, I think, I got some local rice that they had grown and processed.
Interesting.
And I have to say, it's absolutely incredible. Mm. It's totally delicious.
Interesting.
Is this dry?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, now that you mention, I'm not sure.
I would think it would be brand new.
It's brand new to me.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Chris Doy, thanks for your call. Let's see. We'll go to Kevin calling from Auburn. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hey there. I just wanted to give an example of a dish that my partner discovered, and he's a fabulous cook. It's very simple, and it became a household staple, and we taught other people to make it. And it's an Eastern Mediterranean dish, and it's a little different for the American palate, but it is really a great stick-to-your-ribs meal. And it can be done simply or elaborately, but the simple version is egg noodles, a meat sauce, lamb, but if not lamb, hamburger's fine, and then on top of it, garlic cheese, yogurt cheese, which is strained yogurt with garlic in it, and which is fantastic.
Your partner must be Lebanese.
I was thinking Armenian.
And then on top of that, you throw a whole lot of mint on it.
Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect.
Nancy is grinning with happiness. You've eaten something like this.
Yes, indeed. In the Middle East. It's very Middle Eastern. Yeah, you said Armenian. It could be Armenian. It could be Lebanese. It could be any of that North Syrian. But Auburn is an interesting place to have it because that's kind of where Auburn, Lewiston, and Waterville are where a lot of Syrians settled in the early part of the 20th century. So presumably it's entered into the local taste palate somehow.
Kevin, thanks for your call. We have a Facebook post from Robert. The two new cookbooks this Christmas were about sous vide techniques.
Sous vide.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how to pronounce it. Great for flexible timing and easy but perfectly cooked food. Sam, what is sous vide?
Sous vide means under vacuum. So these are foods that are often seasoned, prepared in some way, trimmed, and then put into plastic pouches and sealed under a vacuum, and then heated usually in an immersion cooker, a tank of water that's heated in a controlled way to a very precise temperature for a certain period of time.
Fairly low temperature, too.
It's a very low temperature. Mm-hmm. 85-degree eggs were a big deal about 10 years ago. And I don't know who's doing that. But, you know,
it was a huge chef trend probably a decade ago, everywhere in high-end restaurants. And then it sort of dropped out of sight, and it's become suddenly a home trend in the last year. There have several machines have come out that allow people to do it at home. So also some cookbooks about it.
It sounds like a lot of work.
Cooks.
Is it worth it?
Oh, well, it depends. I don't do it myself. It's something I discourage at my own restaurant, but you certainly can't stop folks from trying new techniques and new ideas.
I think it's really dangerous. I would not, if I were invited to dinner by a home cook who had made a sous vide roast of pork or something like that, I would get an attack of indigestion before I left the house and have to call and say, I'm sorry, I can't come.
It's the low temperature, it's the
plastic, it's all of that. I just think it's really asking for trouble.
We'll go to Barbara calling from Poland. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Sam. Hi, Nancy. How are you? It's Barbie Sullivan.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well.
I'm calling from the tundra. I just wanted to say that I totally agree with you both about the plastic stuff. I don't think that's a good idea at all. But I just wanted to make a little shout for the sea companies in Maine who I mean, it's just unbelievable, both Feto and Johnny's, you know, how many varieties of stuff that you see in the seed catalogs, and then they actually show up at the local farmer's market. And also, I really appreciate what you were saying earlier about, you know, the varieties that are available at these winter farmer's markets. Mm-hmm. We have a great one in Skowhegan. And also our grist mill in Skowhegan. And I mean, I'm a cook. I've done some chef work, but I'm, you know, basically a home cook now, and with little catering thrown in. But I do, you know, I really try to use the freshest ingredients I can, and I just feel like so much more available now year round. But also, you know, I don't want to eat stuff that's that out of season either. I mean, I want to enjoy strawberries in the summertime. I don't want to have these things that have such a big footprint anymore.
Well, Barbara, thank you. Thank you so much for calling. We're getting toward the end of the program, so I'm going to try to move on and take a couple calls. So I appreciate it. We're going to go to Eric calling from near Portland. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going? Love the show. And I just wanted to add two notes. So I host this podcast called Restaurant and Stuff World, where I interview successful.
Eric, can you get a little closer to your phone? You're hard to hear.
Yeah, can you hear me better now?
Yep.
So one of the big lessons I've seen, or the trends I've seen, is no longer food as for health, but food as medicine. People are really turning to food to cure what we've broken in the food system, which is really exciting. We're going back the old ways, and I think one restaurant that's doing this really well is Laney and Lou out of Exeter, New Hampshire, where they're really selling food as medicine, and we're really starting to get back to recognizing food as no longer a commodity, but it's life. And I think it's really great that seeing food as life again. I'm sure Sam Hayward will probably say the same thing.
Eric, thanks so much for calling in.
Well, there's a growing interest in what people sometimes call functional food, which I think is what Eric's getting at. And I certainly believe that food is health, food is life. We should be eating the greatest variety and diversity that we possibly can from the best sources and the best practitioners, growers, farmers, fishers, foragers that we possibly can for maximum health.
Eric, thanks for your call. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more. Here's Christopher calling from Rockland. Hi, Christopher. Go ahead.
Hi, gang. Great show. I'm going to be the curmudgeon calling today. And maybe this may be more directed at Sam. I'm 71, and I've been cooking for myself and my family all of my life, and I think the proliferation of the cookbook industry lets you know that more and more people are being adventurous in their cooking at home. And when I go out to eat, I'm not looking, as you began the program, for comfort foods. I'm not looking to go out and have a comfort food when I eat out. I do very well making those at home. I'm looking to have an experience that's different from what I cook at home.
So I think that is part of the dining out audience, the folks who are looking to get something that they would be too difficult or they don't know how to make at home. But we have everything, don't we, Peggy?
For sure. I was going to say I was going to be the curmudgeon on the show by saying that I don't really like food trends. It frustrates me that there are trends and that there's I don't know. I just feel as though it's become a little bit too close to fashion for comfort to me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Christopher. Sorry, I had to cut you off a little there. That is the end of the program. Peggy Gradinsky, you just heard from, food editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Nancy Harmon Jenkins, a cookbook author and historian and an authority on Mediterranean cuisine. And Sam Hayward, a pioneering chef and partner at 4th Street and Scales in Portland. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, as we mentioned, all about ice fishing in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.